Drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in.
What do Eric Clapton, Nick Drake, and the KLF have in common? The answer is my guest today, the remarkable P.P. Arnold. She started off as an Iquette, one of the backup singers for Ike and Tina Turner. But when she travelled to the UK for a gig in the mid-60s, Mick Jagger convinced her to stick around and launch a solo career. And what a career it's been. Last year, Arnold released a new solo album that's been hiding in the vaults since the 1960s, and she's my guest in the drawing room. Welcome.
Hi.
So, incredible, like, wow, what a career, but I don't even know where to start, but I've got to start somewhere. It's the right thing to do. There can't be too many people who've had Mick Jagger convince them to leave their job. What happened there?
Well, you know, I had arrived in the UK with the Ike and Tina Turner Review. I was an Iquette with the Ike and Tina Turner Review when the River Deep Mountain High single was a big smash hit there. And we were touring the UK as one of the opening acts with the Rolling Stones. And yeah, I just became friends with Mick and the Stones and everybody, as you do, you know, and it was such an amazing time, you know, coming from the U.S. into this whole cosmopolitan revolution, rock and roll pop revolution. And I was walking in the park with Mick one day, as you do.
You're walking in the park.
And he made me a proposition. Yeah, he suggested that I stay in the UK and signed to his manager, who was Andrew Lou Goldham. And Andrew had one of the first independent record labels, Immediate Records, and they thought it would be a good idea for me to stay in the UK and sign to that label and have a solo career that I'd never thought about.
What? What do you mean you'd never thought about?
Never thought about being in the music industry at all. You know, I mean,
you were an Iquette.
Yeah, I was an Iquette, but that was a fluke. You know, that was just a day in the life. Destiny changed my life. I was in a horrible, abusive teen marriage and, you know, said a prayer and my prayer was answered an hour later. And I was called by two friends who were on their way to an audition to be Iquettes, and the girl that was supposed to go with them let them down. So they suggested that I go with them and help them get the gig. So I just basically went along to help them. And when we finished the audition, I mean, an hour after my prayer, 2 hours after my prayer, I was in Ike and Tina's living room singing, dancing in the streets. And afterwards, Tina goes like, "Wow, you got the gig, girls." And I go like, "Oh, no, not me. And, you know, she suggested, I said, "Oh, I'm going to get in trouble. I shouldn't be here." I lied and told my husband I was going shopping and I'm here and I can't do it. I got to go home. So Tina sort of planted this seed. She goes, "Well, if you're going to get in trouble for nothing, why don't you ride to Fresno with us and at least see the gig?" And, you know, it was just one of those days that takes a life of it, you know, had taken on a life of its own. And
but it also must have taken, because you said you were in an abusive situation. Yeah. It must have taken enormous courage as well.
Well, it was just one of those days, you know, my life was hell. And I never went anywhere or did anything. And I had two small children who I loved. And, you know, I was dealing with it and everything. I worked two jobs. So to me, it was just made sense. I was going to get in trouble, and it just seemed like a fun thing to do. I never had fun, so I just went, you know, just went along with the day. I just
rolled
with
everything.
It changed my life. It really changed my entire life, and you know, the whole story, you know, I could get into it.
Well,
it's
this
deep.
Is the
you
thing.
Have to
it takes it's not an overnight thing. Takes years of work then. Is it like basically, you know, something had been sparked inside of you and nothing was going to stop you after
well,
that?
Well, I was a singer, you know. I was born into a family of gospel singers, so I've been singing all my life. So singing was my joy. So to be able to get a job that was my joy, that would help me to get out of this horrible situation that I had prayed to God to show me a way out of. And it was, you know, it was a blessing. So I just went with that. It was a way for me to create a life for myself and some security for my children. And that's how I looked at it. So I rolled with that. And I was with the Ike and Tina Turner Review for 2 years. And then, you know, was with them when they went to the UK. And this opportunity that Mick presented me with came about. So that was another opportunity.
Did you think twice when he offered
you that? Well, of course I did, because there's no way. First of all, like I said, I had never even thought of myself as a solo singer. Being an Ikeette was a job to me. I was very shy. I was very introverted as a result of, you know, the life that I had came out of. And it just, you know, when I was in London, I was having so much fun. It was just so great. And I was, in my mind, I was thinking about leaving the Review because of a lot of the politics that were going on there. And I mentioned that to Mick, and I think that opened up, you know, that opened that up. The universe opened up, and once again, you know, it's just like the light was shining on me, and I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And I called my mother, because I could never do anything without my mother's help of looking after my kids. You know, I had to say, my deal with my mom was that I would stay for 6 months to just to check it out. If it worked, then I would come home and get my kids. And if it didn't work, I would come home. So I was really blessed to be there. And Cat Stevens wrote this amazing song and gave it to me. And it was a big hit. And
yeah.
So I went home and got my kids and brought them back to England.
What was that like, going and getting them and starting off this
new
life? Yeah,
it was really different, you know, because I had left home this young girl and everybody was really sort of excited for me. But it was a big deal, you know, because I was a Black American girl who had never even been, you know, lived in an integrated society or anything. And suddenly little Pat, shy little Pat, was hanging out with the Rolling Stones. You know, so it was quite a big deal, you know. And I came home and, you know, I grew up in South Central L.A., which we call Watts back then. It's still Watts now. And, you know, people came from miles around. My daddy had a barbecue. We had a barbecue and everybody came around just to see me. And
to hear your tales.
And to hear my tales and to get my clothes. Everybody just sort of like stripped me of all my like sort of mini skirts and all my London fashion. I left with my sister and all my friends and my kids, you know, my two kids, they were like 4 and 5 years old, maybe not even 4 and 5, maybe 3 and 4. And so, you know, they were excited. They were going to go to England. You know, they didn't know what England was, but they knew they was going to be with their mommy, who they'd miss. So, yeah, it was pretty amazing.
What an amazing ride.
Yeah.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis. P.P. Arnold is my guest in the drawing room telling me stories that I'm just like, I just want to spend hours hearing them. So you were hanging out with the biggest names in music, but you did describe yourself just now as shy to me. Did you have a front that you put on to hide the shyness?
Absolutely, I did. You know, everybody expects like an American, a Black American girl to be hip and cool.
Yeah, there is the whole stereotype around, isn't
it? And I was so uncool. But I think that's what people kind of, because of my shyness, I think that must have been what they were attracted to, because I didn't even think, you know, I didn't think I was the cutest Ikeette or anything like that. I see those photos of me when I was, you know, and I look at them now, I thought, shit, I look pretty good. I was cute. I was.
But your own self-image at the time was really different.
Yeah, it was low, but I was like in England, so I was like, you know, all the fashions and everything, and I would go shopping with Marianne Faithfull, who was the shopping queen, you know. So Marianne taught me how to shop, and we used to go to Harrods. She told me, yeah, you can buy anything in Harrods. You can even buy an elephant if you want to in Harrods. And we used to go, and Andrew would try to keep me from shopping with Marianne. So, yeah, I had, you know, it was just fun. It was the first time in my life that I was had the opportunity to be a teenager. I was still a teenager, and of course I had blown that when I got pregnant at the age of 15, and I hadn't had a real teenage life, so it was fun. And those 6 months before the responsibility of my kids came, then, yeah, I was having big fun.
To be a fly on the wall there. So tell me about this new album, the Turning Tide.
Yeah, the
How
Turning
has it been
Tide.
Hiding for so long?
It's just, it was crazy, really, that it took so long for that music to be released. Like I said, I was signed to the immediate record label, which is great, and, you know, worked with all my label mates, the Small Faces. I did that stuff with Rod Stewart. You know, Mick had produced my albums, you know, the first cut. I had another hit with a song called Angel of the Morning, and the Small Faces wrote my song, If You Think You're Groovy. I sung with them on Tent Soldier, and, you know, just did so many things. And then suddenly Immediate Records, the label, folded, and everybody scattered and went different ways. So there I was. I didn't know anything about the business. I just knew how to sing, which is probably the same thing now. People, we were at rehearsals yesterday with UMI, and everybody's asking, I go like, I don't know nothing. You
know what I mean? But I know how to sing.
I'm the singer, okay?
Let's get this party started.
You know, that's right. So it was kind of like that, you know, and I didn't know where to go. And I met a guy named Jim Morris, who I later married. And Jim was the driver and assistant to Robert Stigwood, who was the manager of the Bee Gees. And so Jim worked alongside, you know, Barry and the brothers. And Barry, when Barry found out that Jim was going out with me, he wanted to meet me because he really liked my version of To Love Somebody that I recorded on my second album, Kafunta. And so Barry was kind of like at a crossroads. I was at a crossroads. The brothers at that time had kind of split up for a while, and he was eager to do some recording and stuff, and so he decided to produce some tracks on me, and that's what we did. We used to hang out, and, you know, like, he just, like, write songs, you know. It's like, I always say, Barry Gibb is like a river running through him. He's just writing songs all day long. And so we went in the studio and we recorded all this stuff, and he convinced Robert Stigwood to manage me, although Robert didn't really want to manage me, but we had set up the Ahmet Erdogan. Barry organized a dinner party where Ahmet Erdogan of Atlantic Records was there, and we had rehearsed our little tunes, and after dinner, we did some jamming, and Ahmet goes, Stiggy, are you going to sign this girl up? And Stigwood goes, yes. We're getting the contracts. We're getting the contracts again. So that's kind of how I got with Robert, and suddenly I had this record deal, and we did release one of the tracks, Bury Me Down by the River, and Give a Hand, Take a Hand was the B-side of that track, and everything was like kind of going along, but there was like all the politics that was going on as well. And I'm like an artist that has always been produced. My producers have been artists themselves. So if there's something goes wrong in their camp, it affects me. And so, you know, for business reasons and whatever, and the brothers' feud that they were going through, they all got back together, which was, you know, understandably, and I was happy for them as well, because I'm a big Bee Gees fan. I grew up singing with my brothers and sisters, and I know how important it is when you have a family sound with harmonies that tight. I was a big fan, but when they got back together, Robert was not really that interested in, he didn't like the tracks. He didn't like these tracks that have become the Turning Tide album. And so he also managed Eric Clapton. So what he did, Eric was getting ready to go on tour with Eric Clapton, Delaney, Bonnie and Friends, with George Harrison and Billy Preston, who I knew really well from gospel, my gospel days in L.A. And so Robert put me on that tour as a support act. And I had a band, Ashton Gardner and Dyke. They were already a unit, so they backed me. And Steve Howe was my guitarist on that band. And we went on the road and opened up that act. And after that tour, Robert put Eric and I in the studio, and we recorded, you know, we chose three classy covers of that day of that and time to record. You Can't Always Get What You Want, Medicated Goo, the Traffic Tune, and we also did a beautiful, beautiful version of Brand New Day that Van Morrison had written. And so that band, the Delaney and Bonnie Band, which later became the Dominoes, were Eric and that band went in the studio, and we recorded that album. Rita Coolidge on vocals, and Doris Troy, my friend Doris Troy, she's singing on some things as well. And
And now that, given this album has been on the shelves for so many
days. Those tracks were put on. Stiggy didn't like those tracks either, right?
So are there other recordings of yours that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, there's a few more. There's a few more in the covers. There's a few more I've done. So, you know, as a woman in the industry, and like after that time, I never really had a really strong support system behind me. In the 80s, I was with Tin Records for a while, but nobody really knew what to do with me, you know, because I had Immediate, like when I was with Immediate, Andrew Oldham had a vision. You know, he was really into like the West Coast girl group kind of thing, and I come in as an ICAT, and he was like a big fan of Phil Spector, so all of those big orchestrations and that Arthur Green Slade and then Mike Hurst produced all the First Cut stuff. You know, it was all kind of like, and the stuff that Andrew produced was all kind of West Coast girl. So I became like an artist who was an American artist, but I've always worked with British producers. Yeah. So my sound is like different than just a normal R&B chick, you know, and so I have this fusion. And then after Immediate, when I was doing all the beautiful, beautiful ballads with Barry, you know, great songs, I thought, but when I started getting really rootsy and kind of all the stuff that Eric produced was really quite my roots. So Stigwood didn't really know what to do with me. You know, so after that, then he put me in a musical, and I was like, I did the first Rock Othello with Jack Good, and I was, I did that, and I didn't really like that, and then I was trying to find my way, and then I just got lost. I got lost, and everything, it was the 70s, was like the British invasion of America. Now, I was trying to get back to America as part of the British invasion, you know what I mean?
Because I'm British now, I want to come back.
Well, I wanted to come back because the career that I had in the UK would never have happened for me in America like that. And for me to still be in, you know, suddenly I'm in the industry and I don't have anything, but I'm an independent artist, and I had created a kind of a credibility about myself, you know, because I worked with so many other artists and I had this sound. So I was trying to get back there. And so I did a few projects and made some bad decisions. And then I had a lot of tragedy that I dealt with. I lost my daughter in a car accident. And then, you know, so like, it's just like time. And I was in back in the States when that happened. So I found it very difficult to come back to England without Debbie, because my kids grew up in England, and, you know, and she. So when I did come back to the UK, everything had changed, the whole music scene had changed. But I had worked with Andrew Lloyd Webber on the Jesus Christ Superstar album. So when I came back to the UK in 1983, you know, once again, you know, destiny was shining on me, and Andrew was auditioning for Starlight Express. So I got the role of Belle, the sleeping car. I was the original Belle in Starlight Express, so I had to learn how to roller skate and come back on roller skates, you know, and... Yeah, so
I still can't roller skate. So your entire career has been enduring and so successful. Do you still enjoy touring?
I love touring. I'm really glad to be touring at the moment because, you know, I've done a lot of stuff. But like I said, my career, I was doing lots of musicals. And then I had a career, an accident in the mid-80s that kind of, I couldn't tour. I was still recording. That's when I did that stuff with the KLF and the Beatmasters. You know, each decade, the music changes. So I was, you know, lucky to be able to work with so many different artists that kept me going. And then I just, but it was really difficult to get my solo career happening without management. So I've been independent since that time, you know, as an independent artist. So yeah, it's just taken a long time. So even though I didn't really go on the road again until, say, like the 90s when I connected with the Ocean Colour Scene. I toured with them on their Marching Already tour and did we had a hit with the duet, It's a Beautiful Thing. And then I had worked with Roger. I had recorded with Roger on his Amused to Death album in 92. And then I get a call from Roger, from Roger's manager, that Roger was going on tour and Roger wanted me to tour with him on the In the Flesh tour. So I went on the road with Roger, and I had just put a band together with a guy named Chaz Jankel and another great guitar player and some other people, and I was ready to be pee-pee again, right? And then I get this call from Roger's manager saying, oh, Roger's been looking for you and he wants you to go on the road. Would you like to go on the road? And I go like, no, I don't think I can, because I've just... you know, got this band together, just done these two sellout concerts at the Jazz Cafe. I was on my way. And he goes like, but I think Roger would like you to go. I think you might be interested. The money's really good. And I go like, okay, how much? How much? Okay. He goes like, so he told me how much. And I go like, I don't know, you know, just, you know, give Roger my regards and just tell him I really appreciate him wanting me to work with him. But I think, I'll tell you what, I'll think about it. I thought about it for about an hour. And then I called him back. And so, you know, I thought I would do one tour with Roger, and that would, like, help me to make some money so I can, like, really kind of focus on my solo thing. But that one tour ended up being six. I did three In the Flesh tours with him and three Dark Side of the Moon tours, which was the last time I was here, and in Australia and New Zealand, the 2007 tour. So yeah, man, that was great. That was really good for me because I had missed out on that sort of global touring big stadium that all my peers had been a part of. So, and I didn't really see working with Roger is great because that music, that Pink Floyd music, the vocals are really important. So I just think of myself as part of, you know, the sound. You know, I still always wanted to get back to doing P.P. Arnold. So after the last Dark Side tour in 2008, Roger did the Wall, where he didn't have any girls. So I thought, yeah, right, this is my time. And I started, like, touring as P.P. Arnold. It was really hard. It was difficult. The industry changed. It's like starting all over again. And da, 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 da. And then I started, like, really fighting, trying to get these tracks. I finally got the license to release this. And the Turning Tide has turned the tide.
Here we are. We're going to hear one of your songs. We're going to hear the first cut is The Deepest. Is this one of your favorites?
It is really one of my favorites. I love this song. It was my first song that I was lucky to be in the right place when Cat Stevens wrote this song.
I love
song.
This. This is a theme of your life. Lucky to be at the right place.
It really was. But it really was. And this song, you know, I identified with it because the first cut for me really was the deepest. So I love this song and I never tire of singing it. It's such a beautiful song with such a beautiful melody, and I'm a soul singer, so every time I sing it, you know, I'm feeling it, and it's just the song that changed my life.
P.P. Arnold, you have been such a great guest. Thank you so much for coming into the drawing room.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Patricia.
We're both Patricias, aren't we? This is P.P. Arnold with The First Cut is the Deepest.
Baby, I'm trying to love again, but I know the first cut is the deepest. Baby, I know the first cut is the deepest. But when it comes to being lucky, he's cut. When it comes to loving me, he's what. But when it comes to...
That was P.P. Arnold with The First Cut is the Deepest. She was my guest in the drawing room. Her new album is called The Turning Tide, and she's currently on tour across Australia.